This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. All this week, we've been asking who's in charge of the news. And as we've had these conversations, a lot of which were about traditional or legacy media struggling, especially newspapers, and the uncertain future for digital news rising up in its place, the fact is, what's become clear is that you are increasingly going to have to be your own news editor, right? You could leave that to the algorithms of Facebook or Twitter or Apple News, but even then, you have power over what you choose to read, and more importantly, what you choose to share with your networks. For editors in traditional newsrooms, this is a full-time job, often taken after years of working in the field. You'll consult with your reporters and other editors. Sometimes lawyers are brought in. Vetting is done. But when we are acting as editors on Facebook and Twitter, publishing can be just a click away. You don't even have to read the article before you hit share. So to end our week of special coverage, we want to offer a news consumer's guide to following facts, not fiction. More specifically, how you can distinguish credible journalism on social media from posts that are, shall we say, not part of the reality-based community. Joining us today is Stephanie Kraft, a professor who heads the Department of Journalism at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Stephanie, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is Michael Spikes. He's a PhD student in learning sciences at Northwestern University. Mike, welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Mike, throughout this week, we've heard from multiple sources with fewer local newspapers and other journalism organizations stretched to the limit. People in Illinois are getting more of their hyper-local news from social media. Why could that be a problem?
Well, one of the things that we run into and that we talk a lot about, because in my own background and my area of study is in the practice of news media literacy, how we look at it, how we practice it in classrooms, is the places that people go to get their news, and also thinking about these conceptualizations of what a journalist is and what they do. One of the arguments that we make many times is that journalists have a very specialized group of skills and knowledge that they use to build a healthy skepticism about all pieces of information that they get. So they go through processes with other peers in their field to actually vet that information and to make sure that it's true before they publish it. And that's very different than the processes that an individual without those kind of skills would go through. So we would say it's really, really important for people to look for sources that do go through somewhat of a process. As scholars ourselves, like myself and for Stephanie, you know, we go through processes of peer review before we look to publish a study. And that ensures that the information that we publish is reliable and that is credible. So we say that it's more and more important for people to keep those things in mind of the people that they get information from.
All right, Stephanie, we need to take a break in a couple of minutes, but before we do, maybe we can just lay the groundwork for the next part of our conversation. And can you just tell us what exactly is news media literacy?
Well, that's a great question, obviously, and one that really most of the scholarship that I'm involved with and that Michael has been involved with focuses on certain knowledge and skills that people bring to their news consumption. And so I can talk more about this after the break, but there are really a lot of different kinds of things that one needs to know about how news gets produced and the context in which it's produced to be truly literate. And then that set of knowledge about those different things relate to specific skills then that people would bring to their news consumption, you know, how they would search for news, how they would decide what to click on, what to share, and so on.
Yeah, this is so interesting. As somebody who's worked in news for 15 years, I guess it's hard to like forget what I once didn't know about the production of news.
Exactly. So
we're going to dive into that when we come back from our break. Listeners, we want to invite you to join our conversation at 800-222-9455. Maybe you have had that experience of sharing something you thought was news, looked like a legitimate story, only to have a relative or a friend gently suggest maybe it wasn't actually true. Or maybe the suggestion was not so gentle. Either way, we'd love to hear your story. Or if you have any questions about distinguishing news from things that are not news, 800-222-9455 is the number to call. 800-222-9455. 855. News media literacy is the formal term. You might just say distinguishing fact from fiction. We're going to continue our conversation with Professor Stephanie Kraft from the U of I and Michael Spikes from Northwestern University. After a short break, this is the 21st. Stay with us.
Support comes from the Champaign Park District, presenting Renee Elise Goldsberry, original Broadway cast member from Hamilton, live in concert at the Virginia Theater on Saturday, November 6th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets and more information are available online at thevirginia.org.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Stephanie Kraft, head of the journalism department at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, as well as Michael Spikes, who's a PhD candidate in learning sciences at Northwestern University. We are talking about sorting fact from fiction. We are increasingly our own news editors, especially as we've been talking about all week, as traditional media, legacy media, call it what you will, is facing cutbacks, particularly with local newspapers. We are all having to ferret out information ourselves, often on social media, Facebook and Twitter. Sometimes they're from legitimate news sources that sort of abide by traditional processes of fact-checking and verifying information. Sometimes they're not. And according to a U.S. Senate report released in 2018, Russia used every major social media platform to influence the 2016 U.S. election. In particular, Russia targeted conservatives with posts on immigration, race, and gun rights. Left-leaning African-American voters were targeted with misinformation about voting. And there was a big change 4 years later, though. We asked Peter Adams with the News Literacy Project to explain.
I think the big difference we saw between 2016 and 2020 was the proportion of misinformation that was driven by domestic sources. So whereas in 2016, we saw significant interference by Russia and other foreign state actors and coordinated campaigns that were actually surprisingly sophisticated. In 2020, researchers found that the vast majority of information, of misinformation about the campaigns and about the election itself were driven by Americans. So by Americans to Americans.
So Michael, as someone who studies communication, how does uncertainty during, say, an election or a global pandemic, how does that lead to misinformation?
Well, I think one of the things that we run into as consumers of information that we want to use to take action on is that we look for certainty. We have a lot of problems with uncertainty. We've seen that, especially with the pandemic. As we move from one phase to another of the pandemic, a lot of things that we see, we get told one thing one day and then it sort of changes the next. But one of the skills that we talk about in news media literacy classes is that news or other information that comes to us is provisional in its sort of idea of truthiness. And we have to become much more comfortable with uncertainty in the world. There are very few things within our world that are certain, but what we have to do is to gather pieces of evidence to bring us closer to what we might call the truth, but we also have to be open and be remembering that there may be new evidence that may come out that may tell us that what we believed yesterday might need to be updated. So it's really, really important for us to keep that in mind, that uncertainty is something that we'll always be confronted with.
Stephanie, how do you think about that, right? I think that we've heard a lot of changing of sort of official recommendations on COVID-19 as an example, right? People, first it was don't wear masks, then it's wear masks. I think those people who have that sort of understanding of how government works and how the scientific method works, maybe you understand that sometimes you get new information and you change, but that can often lead to sort of a diminishment in trust when when that changes. And then this happens in journalism, right? They call it the first draft of history for a reason. How do you think about the uncertainty that Michael was talking about and the need to update information and how that affects trust in the media?
Well, first, I think that was a great point that Michael made about uncertainty and kind of having an embrace of uncertainty, or at least an acknowledgement of it, be a central part of any kind of news literacy training or curriculum. It relates directly, I think, to this idea about understanding the contexts and practices and so on that go into news production so that consumers can sort of understand, well, why is it so uncertain, right? I think Michael and others are right that people are always going to be searching for certainty, and that might help explain why people will share news of dubious quality if it came from a friend, because they feel certain about the friend, right? But that can lead to some pretty bad information sharing practices, if no one's actually going and looking at the story to figure out if it's true or not, and sharing it nevertheless. So that idea about uncertainty, I think, speaks to some of the knowledge and skills that form kind of a backdrop of news literacy, or maybe a comprehensive sense of what it entails, right? Having kind of background knowledge, say, take it out of the news context for a second. If you were talking about being an informed just citizen about how your government works, right, you would have background knowledge about, oh, there are three branches of government and we have elections and there are representatives, here's the Supreme Court. Like, having just that basic understanding of the structure in which political things happen, how laws get made and so on, that's the backdrop knowledge that's essential to understanding on a day-to-day basis what's happening in politics, right? And I think a similar thing is happening, or ought to be happening, in how we think about news literacy, that there's a lot of background knowledge that can help us then deal with the day-to-day kinds of issues of uncertain or dubiously sourced information coming our way.
Listeners, you're welcome to join our conversation. 800-222-9455 is the number. And we have Steve on the line from DeKalb. Steve, thank you for calling in.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to touch on a couple of things briefly. One is being careful when searching on the internet and how sponsored content pops up first. And the thing that you're actually looking for is usually you have to scroll down for if you want to find it. And I, even though I know this, I make that mistake quite regularly, where I click on the wrong thing and I go, oops, and I have to go up and scroll down. Secondly, something that just happened to me within the last hour. I was trying to click on a video of the Poor People's Campaign press conference in front of the Capitol yesterday. And when I went to click it on, instead what came up was a Facebook Live program of a right-wing blogger. And so one must be careful about what they're clicking. And I have a question regarding that. Sure. Was that some kind of sponsored content of Facebook where they paid for the ability to push their live blog up to a point where I made that mistake, assuming I made a mistake?
Interesting. All right, Steve, thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it. Michael, how about that? I know I used to cover state government here in Illinois, and for a time, one of the conservative advocacy or policy organizations paid so that if you ever searched for any of the sort of public employee unions like AFSCME, you would get taken to the conservative site first. Mm-hmm. Those would be the top results, and they would be encouraging people to stop paying, their dues, sort of thing. How do you react to what Steve was asking about there?
Yeah, I think the thing that pops up for me, and this is something that I talk to my own students about, is thinking about what are the goals that the consumer has for seeking out information from certain platforms, compared to the goals of the platforms that they get that information from. And they don't always match, as the caller mentioned. On Facebook, he may have come across an advertisement when trying to look for information from that particular campaign he was looking for. And it is true that these platforms, they are businesses and they need to make money. And some of the ways that they, well, one of the main ways they make money is through advertising and through, you know, a sort of the sponsored content that he mentioned, which was one of the forms of advertising that have been developed from these platforms. So I think it's really, really important for consumers of information to think about what is the goal I have here, and to keep in mind that the goals that they have for the information that they're looking for does not always line up with the goals of the platform.
Yeah, and I guess there's no rules against if you are a right-wing organization or a left-wing organization, for that matter, and you can buy the search terms of the other side, right? So that you can advertise that when people do those searches or look for that content, maybe your material will come up first. I want to play another bit of tape. We asked, again, this is Peter Adams, Senior Vice President of Education at the News Literacy Project, how to know if a story or a meme or a GIF on Facebook or another social media platform is, in fact, fact-based and is okay to share. Here's what he told us.
When it comes to sharing posts about civic matters like politics or social issues, it's best to make sure that what you're sharing is accurate. If there's a link to another source involved, make sure it's a standards-based source that has processes of verification in place and strives to be as fair and accurate as possible in the information it produces. I would add that lots of people, including people we love and generally trust in our lives, share or reshare false claims. You know, sometimes these are just statements, what we call sheer assertions, with no evidence at all. But sometimes these kinds of baseless claims can take other forms. So a photo without attribution or context, or a screenshot of a headline but no link, or a meme.
Stephanie, do you have any other advice on finding and sharing only stories that are based in fact?
Well, first, I want to credit Steve, the caller, for actually demonstrating good news literacy skills, that he was bringing some skepticism to what he was finding in search results and what happened in his experience trying to view a video that he wanted to view on Facebook. It's that very idea of understanding, you know, as Michael pointed out, that there are different goals that the message creator has, maybe from your goals as a consumer of that message. So, you know, the five, I'm going to nerd out on you a little bit here. The kind of five C's of news literacy that we think about in research are context, creation, content, circulation, and consumption. And those represent kind of all these different domains about how news is produced and distributed and so on that, again, form that kind of backdrop knowledge that people ought to have, I think, so that then they can bring that to, you know, any particular instance of, oh, someone has shared something with me on Facebook, or, oh, I see a news story or a video on YouTube that looks weird. The circulation C, right, really speaks to exactly what Steve was talking about, which is understanding how search results come to you, right? That the top result doesn't necessarily mean it's the most credible result, that it's based on a different kind of algorithm. And it's actually surprising how many people don't know that basic thing that Steve knows, right? That the search results are driven by something other than quality or credibility. So, you know, kudos to Steve and to those of you out there. But I think that having kind of this comprehensive view of news literacy that then you can bring to any particular instance is important.
And I want to thank, we had somebody call in. I don't think we're gonna have time to take the call, but Karen from the League of Women Voters of Champaign County leads a team there addressing misinformation around voting and elections in Illinois, and has a list of fact check sites. And we will put a link to that. Thank you for calling in with that, Karen. We'll have a link to that on our website, 21stshow.org, if people want to see this list of sites to help fight misinformation, particularly around elections. Just about a minute left. Michael, there's one other thing I wanted to ask you about. A lot of news organizations have put up paywalls, right, to try and stay financially viable. But you've studied the way some people think that actually hurts journalism's credibility. Can you just talk briefly about that and what news organizations might do instead?
I don't know if I would say it hurts credibility, but in particular, What people find is they may tend to assign levels of credibility based on how accessible information is. But one of the things that people may need to keep in mind is that there are processes that go behind, like what Stephanie was talking about, that circulation of that information, the creation of that information. And because of that, it does take resources to do so. So even with news outlets in particular, putting up paywalls, it could be, I mean, essentially, this could be a cue to the consumer that there is a process behind the creation of that information. There are people there who have a particular goal of informing those of that information to make sure that that information is credible. They have a system in place to do so.
All right. Well, this has been an interesting conversation. Michael Spikes and Stephanie Kreft, I want to thank you both so much for being with us and sharing your knowledge with us today on the 21st.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
Michael Spikes is a PhD candidate in learning sciences at Northwestern University. Stephanie Kreft is professor and head of the Department of Journalism at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And that is all the time we have for this week. I want to thank you so much for going with us on this journey as we explored who is in charge of the news all week on the 21st. You can find our past conversations on these topics on our website, 21stshow.org, or you can just subscribe to our podcast feed. All the conversations are there. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, NPR One, anywhere else you get your podcasts, and you can figure out, as we've been trying to do, who, in fact, is in charge of the news. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. Back to regular programming next week.